Okay, everybody's in.
Okay, hopefully there'll be more coming. Let's see who's here. Ben and Kirsten, Luca, Nadell, and Risto. Welcome, everyone. So, as you all know, this webinar series is available on Makara.us. I just say this for people who step into the series late and want to have access to other sessions. So, I know it's repetitive, but I try to get through it as quickly as possible. Yeah, you can find it under Wayfarers and Webinars, and then the current list of webinar series and progress. All episodes of this, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, and The Treatise on Cosmic Fire are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you'd like to view. You can access, that is, you can join any of these webinars by just going to moifederation.com, find the title you want to join, click on it, you'll get another page, and then click on that and you'll be in. In case you lose your link, that's a surefire way to get in. You can also go to the Mori Federation calendar and see what's coming up and click on the link right in the calendar and get to the webinar that way as well. Okay, we're going to do a real short reading this month in Old Diary Leaves, where Colonel Olcott travels to Ambassamudram. Can we get a reader, please?
I'll start us off. On the evening after our arrival in Ambassamudram, we had the real pleasure of hearing a recitation of Purahas in the ancient style by an actor. There was a musical accompaniment on Indian instruments by a very good band. One can imagine what a gratification it would be, European Sanskritists. If one of their Oriental congresses, they could hear the sonorous slokas of the Aryan scriptures recited so beautifully as they were by this orator on the above occasion. On the way to the Rishi Peak, we halted at the Bannatithim Falls and slept in the forest officer's bungalow at Mundan Pore. And although there were no doors to keep out the cold air, no furniture, swarming mosquitoes to be counted by the cubic inch, and rumors of elephants and tigers being near, we slept the sleep of the weary.
Thank you, BL. All right. Says unable to start video. Is disabled by the host. I just guess she finally got tired of looking at my face.
Wait a minute.
Let me try again. Nope. Disabled.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's my fault. That's my fault. Now can you do it?
Yay, thank you. Okay, so we are currently exploring the first verse of the seventh and final stanza in the first volume of The Secret Doctrine, where we've been making our way through the celestial orders from highest to lowest. They're directly related to the hierarchies as taught by DK. Last time we started with the all-important fifth order, the Manasaputras, which DK calls solar angels. We learned that they are symbolized by the five-pointed star and are connected with Capricorn, which in India is called Makara or crocodile. Makara also represents Manas, the bridge between spirit, Atmabuddhi, and matter. We then explored the sixth and seventh groups, which are the lowest of the seven celestial orders and directly correspond to the sixth and seventh manifested hierarchies. The sixth celestial order are composed of lunar lords, called also the great or the greater builders, only greater in relation to the elemental lives whose substance they use to build with. They're also called the sacrificial fires, the Barkhishad Pitris, and the lunar ancestors. They use the energy of matter called Kundalini Shakti and are ruled by sixth ray Mars. In the seventh hierarchy, we find the lesser builders who determine the archetypal patterns through which the forms of the etheric physical plane are produced. These include also those elemental lives that constitute the positive pole of the energy found at the heart of every atom. And this takes us up to where we left off last time. The passage that sets us up for our first reading of this session states, gods created as such, meaning created full-blown without having developed through countless eons of lesser lives, would evince no personal merit in being gods. Such a class of beings, perfect only by virtue of the special immaculate nature inherent in them, in the face of suffering and struggling humanity, and even of the lower creation, would be the symbol of an eternal injustice, quite satanic in order, and ever-present crime. So HPB is here giving us a kind of what-if scenario that underscores the natural justice in the laws of karma that governs the path of becoming. You know, there are no such gods, you know, that just emerge full-blown without having developed over eons. Okay, so that leads us into this next reading. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes. Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. It is an anomaly and an impossibility in nature. Therefore, the four and the three have to incarnate as all other beings have. The sixth group, moreover, remains almost inseparable from man, who draws from it all but his highest and lowest principles, or his spirit and body. The five middle human principles being the very essence of those Dhyanis. Alone, the divine ray, the Atman, proceeds directly from the One. When asked how that can be, how is it possible to conceive that those gods or angels can be at the same time their own emanations and their personal selves? Is it in the same sense in the material world, where the son is in one way his father, being his blood, the bone of his bone, and the flesh of his flesh? To this, the teachers answer, "Verily, it is so." But one has to go deep into the mystery of being before one can fully comprehend this truth.
Thank you, Kirsten. So, first, it is an anomaly and an impossibility in nature. It just doesn't happen, which is this idea of a full-blown entity emerging out of nothing. Therefore, the four and the three have to incarnate as all other beings have. So the it that's being described here, that is an anomaly and an impossibility in nature, references the idea of a quote, sudden appearance on the plane of life as a full-blown god. It's just a concept that HPB is exploring in order to further teach us about the nature of how all beings develop through karma and the evolutionary path. Okay, as to the three and the four, there are at least two ways to interpret the phrase the four and the three, both of which are described in the stanzas of Zan. The first comes from the idea expressed in verse four of stanza two, quote, her heart had not yet opened for the one ray to enter, thence to fall as three into four into the lap of Maya. So this verse references the incorporeal higher triad, which for human beings is Atmanbuddhi-manas, which is a source of the lower quaternary. But there's another way to look at the four and the three. And an example of that comes from verse seven of stanza three, my favorite verse in all the stanzas. Here we have the one as four, which takes to itself three, suggesting, for example, the four super cosmic etheric planes taking to itself the lower three cosmic planes, which also works at the level of the cosmic physical plane, where the four cosmic etheric planes, quote unquote, take to themselves the lower three subplanes of the cosmic physical plane. This latter is the model being used to describe the work of the sixth and seventh groups of hierarchies. Any thoughts or questions about this? Anytime, guys, you know the drill. It's always more interesting to have a discussion than to just have a monologue. So if you have any questions or thoughts on anything, just keep it pertinent to the subject matter at hand. Just raise your hand. Okay, next we have this sixth group, moreover, remains almost inseparable from man, who draws from it all but his highest and lowest principles, or his spirit and body, the five middle human principles being the very essence of those dhyanis. So the sixth order of dhyani chohans, or greater builders, are conscious etheric beings whose very substance underlies our subtle bodies. When HPB says they, quote, remain almost inseparable from man, she means that humanity draws five of its seven principles directly from these beings. The two extremes of our constitution, pure spirit, Atma, and the dense physical body, the stula sharira, fall outside this domain. But the five middle principles, spiritual soul or buddhi, mind, manas, desire nature, kama, life force, prana, and the astral or linga sharira are literally, quote, the very essence of those dhyanis. So it is that the sixth creative order, using substance drawn from the seventh, is the living matrix, not of the indwelling spirit, but rather of our series of subtle vehicles. Let's take a look at the footnote referenced by the term the very essence of those dhyanis. Could we get a reader for this, please?
Ron, can you read that for us, please?
When Paracelsus calls them
Paracelsus.
Paracelsus calls them the fledgling, the Christians, the guardian angels, the occultists, the ancestors of Pitris. They are the sixfold Dian koans, having the six spiritual elements and the co composition of their bodies. In fact, men minus the physical body.
Thank you, Ron. So these builders, by whatever name, are the living templates of for our sixfold subtle vehicles. As guardians, they guide individual souls through karmic cycles, hence the name guardian angels. Finally, alone, the divine ray, the Atman, proceeds directly from the One. When asked, how can that be? How is it possible to conceive that those gods or angels can be at the same time their own emanations and their personal selves? Is it in the same sense in their material world, where the Son is, in one way, his Father, being his blood, the bone of his bone, and the flesh of his flesh? To this, the teacher answers, verily, it is so. But one has to go deep into the mystery of being before one can fully comprehend this truth. So HBB here describes what is called in theosophy the doctrine of emanation, which states that spirit flows out of the absolute, yet remains identical with its source, that every divine being or angel is an expression of the absolute or Parabrahman, yet retains its own individual existence. We get some understanding by seeing these gods as living rays of the One, capital O, that carry the same essence, even as they manifest distinct qualities rather than separate fragments. This is the mystery behind what DK calls identification. Krishna saying, having pervaded the universe with a fragment of myself, I remain. That's the idea of the immanent and the transcendent, as the two expressions of the divine aspect. Yes, Barbara.
I'm wondering if the Dion Chohans have ray structures that individuate them in some way, and if the individuation of the Dion Chohan is related to that of the human.
Well, first of all, they respond to the third aspect, so therefore to the third ray. Their activity is in what's called intelligent activity, because they're the builders of the form aspect. And they exist at many, many levels, all the way from elementals up to Devic lords, great Devic lords. At a certain point, they merge with the human kingdom. At the sixth human initiation, they emerge with the human kingdom. My guess is that when they become conscious of their monastic principle, that then they would begin to display ray types, not before that. Except for in the sense that they are the builders that are under the influence of the third ray in general. But at a certain point, I would think, yes, that they would gain it, and it would have to do with a monastic predisposition. At some point, they merge with the human kingdom, and from there on, it really is a combined line of evolution. That doesn't fully answer your question, because one thing is that DK doesn't talk much about the David Kingdom in terms of the nature of the influences on the individual David like he does for humanity. Anyone else? Okay. Next, we come to a verse, to verse 2, which states the one ray multiplies the smaller rays. Life precedes form, and life survives the last atom of form, stula sharira, external body. Through the countless rays, the life ray, the one, like a thread through many beads or pearls. HPB chose not to divide her commentary on this verse into sections. Could we get a reader, please?
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
This shloka expresses the conception, a purely Vedantic one, as already explained elsewhere, of a life thread, sutratma, running through successive generations. How can then can this be explained? By resorting to a simile, to a familiar illustration, though necessarily imperfect, as all our available analogies must be. Before resorting to it, however, I would ask whether it seems unnatural, least of all supernatural, to any of us, any one of us, when we consider that process known as the growth and development of a fetus into a healthy baby weighing several pounds evolves from what? From the segmentation of an infinitesimally small ovum and a spermatozoa, and afterwards we see that the baby develops into a 6-foot man. This refers to the atomic and physical expansion from the microscopically small into something very large, from the to the naked eye unseen into the visible and objective.
Thank you, Scott. So first, this shloka expresses the conception, a purely Vedantic one, meaning connected to the original Aryan teachings, as already explained elsewhere, of a life thread, sutratma, running through successive generations. So the term successive generations refers to successive incarnations, which the one sutratma or life thread strings together. In Vedanta, the sutratma is the golden thread of the immortal ego that runs through every incarnation. Just as a string holds beads in sequence, the life thread binds together each personality we've ever been and will ever be. Birth and death merely wrap and unwrap these successive beads, which are your bodies and individual lives, around that single unbroken thread of developing consciousness. Okay, so just to know what she's talking about here, right? Next, this whole rest of this, which I will quickly reread. How then can this be explained? By resorting to a simile, to a familiar illustration, though necessarily imperfect, as all our available analogies must be. Before resorting to it, however, I would ask whether it seems unnatural, least of all supernatural, to any of us when we consider that process known as growth and development of a fetus into a healthy baby weighing several pounds evolves from what? From the segmentation of an infinitesimally small ovum and spermatozoon. And afterwards, we see that baby develop into a 6-foot man. This refers to the atomic and physical expansion from the microcosmically small into something very large, from the to the naked eye unseen into the visible and objective. So what HPB is asking with the question, how then can this be explained, is how can one undifferentiated life ray unfold into a seemingly endless series of forms? HPB then uses the growth of a fetus as an analogy. Through division and organization, the minuscule seed of a single microscopic ovum plus a spermatozoan expands, quote unquote, into a fully formed baby, then into an adult. In the same way, HPB here suggests the one life ray, quote unquote, expands outward, weaving the myriad and successive physical forms of a human being. Of course, fetal development unfolds in a single linear lifetime under biological laws, whereas the one life ray spans countless life cycles, multiple planes, and an eternal life thread that demonstrates only briefly through one incarnation. Yet the connection is there, and she makes the analogy based on that. Any thoughts or questions? Okay, next up. Could we get a reader, please?
And can you read that for us, please?
Science has provided for all this, and I dare say her theories, embryological, biological, and physiological, are correct enough so far as exact observation of the material goes. Nevertheless, the two chief difficulties of the science of embryology, namely, what are the forces at work in the formation of the fetus, and the cause of hereditary transmission of likeness, physical, moral, or mental, have never been properly answered, nor will they ever be solved until the day when scientists condescend to accept the occult theories. But if this physical phenomenon astonishes no one, except in so far as it puzzles the embryologists, why should our intellectual and inner growth, the evolution of the human spiritual to the divine spiritual, be regarded as or seem more impossible than the other? Now to the simile.
Thank you, Ben. Okay, first. Science has provided for all this, and I dare say her theories, embryological, biological, and physiological, are correct enough so far as exact observation of the material goes. So it's true, science has at least somewhat mapped the observable universe, and in fact has made huge strides in embryology and biology since publication of The Secret Doctrine. Next, nevertheless, the two chief difficulties of the science of embryology, namely, what are the forces at work in the formation of the fetus and the cause of hereditary transmission of likeness, physical, moral, or mental, have never been properly answered. Okay, so since HPB's time, science has made significant advancement in embryology, but it still lacks a unified systems level explanation for how a single fertilized egg self-organizes into the complex form and integrated physiology of a fully developed fetus. You know, the term self-organizes in some ways gives the whole problem away, right? They can only see it. science, that is, or embryologist, as a process of self-organization. Occultists would see another hand being played in that organization. As to hereditary transmission, since HPB's time, science has discovered that DNA segments carry inherited information. In fact, since HPB's time, DNA itself and RNA has been discovered, right? Shows you how far back these writings go. And that they carry inherited information. And that there is a chemical basis for replication and mutation of cells. But though science has developed a more advanced material mechanism, a quite convincing one, in fact, for passing on physical and even some neural predispositions, it still lacks a unified understanding of how certain complex traits, especially mental and moral tendencies, are encoded and transmitted across generations. It's like, and we all know this, that there's certain qualities that survive from generation to generation that are not found in DNA or RNA. Next, nor will they ever be solved till the day when scientists condescend to accept the occult theories. I love her tongue in cheek on condescend, right? So the two subjects just presented, namely the forces at work in the formation of the fetus and the cause of hereditary transmission of likeness, physical, moral, or mental, will never be solved by scientists until, probably through development of etheric vision, they begin to explore non-substantive causes of these two subjects, such as the existence of permanent atoms and the influences of karma. Next. But if this physical phenomena astonishes no one, except insofar as it puzzles the embryologists, why should our intellectual and inner growth, the evolution of the human spiritual to the divine spiritual, be regarded as or seem more impossible than the other, meaning more impossible than the phenomenal growth of the material realm? So, since even skeptics accept that a microscopic ovum and sperm respond to forces unknown to embryologists, which results in an adult human being, why, HPB here asks, should acceptance of these unseen, admittedly unseen forces, be any different than acceptance of the unseen forces of occultism? Neither invisible mechanism should be deemed quote unquote supernatural once one admits that biology itself depends on hidden agencies. You see the argument she's making here? Okay. Any thoughts or questions so far? All right, next up, the footnote referenced by the term occult theories. Could we get a reader, please? We're going into the weeds a bit here, but I think you'll get a sense of her purpose as we do this.
Marguerite, can you read that for us, please?
The materialists and the evolutionists of the Darwinian school would be ill-advised to accept the newly worked out theories of Professor Weissman, the author of Betrash Zur, I'm not going to even try, with regard to one of the two mysteries of embryology, as above specified, which he seems to have solved, as he thinks. For when it is solved, science will have stepped over into the domain of the truly occult and stepped forever out of the realm of transformation as taught by Darwin. The two are irreconcilable from the standpoint of materialism. Regarded from that of the occultist, it solves all these mysteries. Those who are not acquainted with the new discovery of Professor Weissman, at one time a fervent Darwinist, ought to hasten to repair the deficiency. The German embryologist philosopher shows, thus stepping over the heads of the Greek Hippocrates and Aristotle, right back into the teachings of the old Aryans, one infinitesimal cell out of millions of others at work in the formation of an organism, determining alone and unaided, by means of constant segmentation and multiplication, the correct image of the future man or animal in its physical, mental, and psychic characteristics.
Thank you, Marguerite. So first, the materialist and the evolutionists of the Darwinian school would be ill-advised to accept the newly worked out theories of Professor Weissman, the author of Beitreis, or, oh gosh, I don't know in German what this would be, something like Desandenslehre. Is any Germans among you want to correct my pronunciation? Beatrice de Desandenslehre, with regard to one of the two mysteries of embryology, as above specified, which he seems to have solved, as he thinks. So, okay, a lot of this is going to take some untangling, right? Weissman claimed to have cracked the second mystery by showing that hereditary material resides solely in the sperm and egg, and that changes to the body during a person's lifetime affect only the individual, not their offspring, and thus can't be inherited. This framework is still accepted by modern embryologists. Furthermore, there is in modern science extensive evidence that mental and behavioral traits are heritable and encoded via DNA, though no one gene governs intelligence or some specific behavioral pattern. But this is no refutation of occult science. It is not possible, even likely, that the, is it not possible, even likely, that the quality and nature of one's physical, emotional, and mental traits held in the permanent atoms are impressed on one's DNA? They're not irreconcilable systems. They could be working, and I would hypothesize, do work together. Next.
Francis?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want you to know that I translated it, the name of the book. It's the Beitrage zur Desandenslehre, or something similar, is Contributions to the Theory of Descent.
Oh, of course it is. Thank you, BL. Okay. Well, that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Contributions to the what of descent? To the...
To the theory of descent. I'm sorry, I closed it out already.
Yeah, okay. All right, so next, for when it is solved, science will have stepped over into the domain of the truly occult and stepped forever out of the realm of transformation as taught by Darwin. So transformation is taught by Darwin is the idea that species arise and change solely by, and here's the key word, undirected variation plus natural selection. This, especially the undirected part, is of course an anathema to theosophy's cyclical emanation model, where forms unfold from and dissolve back into an eternal, intelligent reality, rather than steadily evolving one species into another, as taught by Darwin on a purely physical level. It's all a question of cause and effect. Darwin places the cause in the material realms. Theosophy, along with, by the way, all religious philosophies, places that cause in the unseen. Next, the two are irreconcilable from the standpoint of materialism, regarded from that of the occultists, it solves all these mysteries. So for the materialist, Darwinian evolution, or forms arising and changing purely by blind, undirected physical mechanisms, and on the other hand, theosophical occult cosmogony rests on completely different premises, and so cannot be merged or reconciled. That's according to the Darwinist, right? You're either right or you're wrong, right? Whereas the occultist sees a single overarching paradigm that explains both physical evolution and spiritual evolution. I was giving an example of that when I said that couldn't it be that the permanent atoms literally impress our DNA? Okay. Next. Those who are not acquainted with the new discovery of Professor Weissman, at one time a fervent Darwinist, ought to hasten to repair the deficiency. The German embryologist philosopher shows, thus stepping over the heads of the Greek Hippocrates and Aristotle, right back into the teachings of the old Arians, one infinitesimal cell out of millions of others at work in the formation of an organism, determining alone and unaided by means of the constant segmentation and multiplication, the correct image of the future man or animal in its physical, mental, and psychic characteristics. So HPB here champions Weizmann's germplasm theory, that's what it was called, which posits that the substance or germplasm that carries the hereditary blueprint operates independently of acquired traits or bodily experience, and thus remains unchanged from one generation to the next, thus echoing ancient Vedic ideas where a singular living essence, a seed unit, quote unquote, also called in Egyptian philosophy, a bindu, determines the nature of the creation that follows. This seed is not merely biological, it is etheric and spiritual, formed in the causal body and shaped by past lives, past karma, and cosmic law. It is the image of the future man, quote unquote, held in the higher planes and precipitated into physical incarnation. So HPB is seeing a step made forward by Weissman here towards the awareness. And the best thing about it of all is that it's still an accepted theory. So by aligning Weizmann with this quote-unquote old Aryan cosmogony, HPB shows that occult tradition anticipated Weizmann's germ plasm concept millennia before modern embryology. Okay, it's a little bit thick, like some of her footnotes tend to be, but also you find that some of the best stuff, the real true blue occultism, is found in these footnotes. Any thoughts or questions so far? I'm seeing a couple of chats. Let me check this out.
Yes. Okay, go ahead, read Ben's.
Oh yeah, here we have by Ben, yeah. Okay, Ben Stock gives us some interesting thoughts here. You can open in the chat box and follow along if you want. I'll read them out. 1869, Friedrich Miescher first isolated a substance he called nucleon from white blood cells, which we now know as DNA. 1953, James Watson and Francis Crick, building on Rosalind Franklin's X-ray diffraction work, unveiled the double helix structure of the DNA. This was the moment DNA was recognized as the molecule that carries genetic information. Yeah, thanks for that background, Ben. All of this, the latter half of this, the discovery of the DNA, all happened after Blavatsky. All right, next up, we finished the footnote. Can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Maydell, can you read that for us, please?
It is that cell which impresses on the face and form of the new individual the features of the parents or of some distant ancestor. It is that cell again which transmits to him the intellectual and mental idiosyncrasies of his sires and so on. This plasm is the immortal portion of our bodies, simply through the process of successive assimilations. Darwin's theory, viewing the embryological cell as an essence or the extract from all other cells, is set aside. It is incapable of accounting for hereditary transmission. There are but two ways of explaining the mystery of heredity. Either the substance of the germinal cell is endowed with the faculty of crossing the whole cycle of transformations that lead to the construction of a separate organism and then to the reproduction of identical germinal cells, or those germinal cells do not have their genesis at all in the body of the individual, but proceed directly from the ancestral germinal cell passed from father to son through long generations. It is the latter hypothesis that Weissman accepted and has worked upon, and it is to this cell that he traces the immortal portion of man. So far, so good. And when this almost correct theory is accepted, how will biologists explain the first appearance of this everlasting cell? Unless man, quote, grew, close quote, from the, quote, immortal Topsy, close quote, and was not born at all, but fell from the clouds, how was that embryological cell born in him?
Thank you, Nadal. First, it is that cell which impresses on the face and form of the new individual the features of the parents or of some distant ancestor. It is that cell again, which transmits to him the intellectual and mental idiosyncrasies of his sires, and so on. This plasm is the immortal portion of our bodies, simply through the process of successive assimilations. Okay, the quote unquote cell in that cell is the fertilized ovum, which carries a lineage by means of Weissman's germ plasm. It is this substance that carries the full hereditary blueprint of the dense physical body, as well as the quote unquote intellectual and mental idiosyncrasies. Though modern science tells us that intellect is less predictable through germ cell lineage than physical body characteristics. Next, Darwin's theory, viewing the embryological cell as an essence of the extract from all other cells, is set aside. It is incapable of accounting for hereditary transmission. Indeed, Darwin's theory, called pangenesis, is today considered obsolete as a general theory of inheritance, not just by occultists, but by scientists, as a theory of inheritance, whereas Weissman's germline theory, as well as the later discovered DNA and RNA, form the basis for modern embryology. So the occult ideology is built into the acceptance of this germline theory that Weissman put forward, but it hasn't been explored at its deeper levels as yet. Next, there are but two ways of explaining the mystery of heredity. Either the substance of the germinal cell is endowed with the faculty of crossing the whole cycle of transformations that lead to the construction of a separate organism and then to the reproduction of identical germinal cells, or those germinal cells do not have their genesis at all in the body of the individual, but proceed directly from the ancestral germinal cell, passed from father to son through long generations. Okay, the first of these two models puts forth the idea that a fertilized egg contains a substance capable of morphing into the tissue of the new organism, then regenerating an identical germ cell from that reorganized substance. This is a completely materialistic model because it is based on the embryonic differentiation within the individual. In the second model, every sperm and egg represents an unbroken lineage of ancestral germplasm carried forward intact from parent to child over countless generations. Same germplasm, right? Carried over countless generations, thus forming a direct transmission of a single immortal germinal essence. And finally, it is the latter hypothesis that Weissman accepted and has worked upon, and it is to this cell that he traces the immortal portion of man. So far, so good. And when this almost correct theory is accepted, how will biologists explain the first appearance of this everlasting cell, unless man, quote unquote, grew like the, quote, immortal Topsy and was not born at all, but fell from the clouds? How was that embryological cell born in him? So after a conditional endorsement of Weissman's germline theory, HBB here challenges biologists to explain not just how traits are passed down, okay, but how the very first carrier of those traits ever came to exist. An ultimate mystery, unexplainable by science, that Blavatsky insists only occult theory truly addresses. The quote, immortal Topsy, was a character created by Harriet Beecher Stowe, who popped into existence out of thin air, having here used to highlight science's lack of a theory for original cause. Okay, kind of dense material, but now we get back to the main text. Could we get a reader, please?
Sure. Janet, can you read that, please?
Now to the simile. Complete the physical plasm mentioned in the last footnote, the germinal cell of man with all its material potentialities, with the spiritual plasm, so to say, or the fluid that contains the five lower principles of the sixth principled Dian. And you have the secret. If you are spiritual enough to understand it, when the seed of the animal man is cast into the soil of the animal woman, that seed cannot germinate unless it has been fructified by the five virtues. The fluid of or the emanation from the principles of the sixfold heavenly man. Wherefore, the microcosm is represented as a pentagon, with the hexagon star, the macrocosm.
Well, hold off on the Greek.
Yeah, a work. Well, Anne's here.
Yeah, and Veronica, what's that? What's that word?
Anthropos. Anthropos. It means anthropos. Human being.
Sure, sure. Okay, thank you.
Anthropos, a work of occult embryology, book one. Then the functions of Jiva on this earth are of a fivefold character. In the mineral atom, it is connected with the lowest principles of the spirits of the earth, the sixfold dyads. In the vegetable particle, with their second, the prana life in the animal, with all these plus the third and the fourth. In man, the germ must receive the fruitation of all the five.
Fruition, yes. Thank you, Janet. Okay, first, now to the simile. Complete the physical plasm, mentioned in the last footnote, the germinal cell of man with all its material potentialities, with the spiritual plasm, so to say, or the fluid that contains the five lower principles of the six principle dion, and you have the secret, if you are spiritual enough to understand it. Vintage HPB. So the simile that HPB here offers compares the physical and spiritual plasm, or means of hereditary transmission. The physical plasm is the germinal cell, which is the ovum plus the sperm, right? With all its biochemical and genetic potentialities, what modern biology studies under embryology and heredity. By itself, it contains the blueprint for a person's basic temperament, even to some extent their neural wiring. But there is nothing in it that carries the consciousness aspect. The spiritual plasm is made up of a subtle fluid, we're here told, or vibratory field emanating from the Dion Chohans, which surrounds and conditions the five lower principles of our sevenfold constitution, through which higher spirit, or Atman, descends into matter. When both streams, the physical and spiritual, pour into a new embryo, you get the complete human being, body, mind, and consciousness. The phrase, if you are spiritual enough, implies that it takes a certain spiritual sensitivity to sense these two currents at work. The term six principle, when describing the dhyanis, means that unlike a human being who has seven principles, these beings have all but the gross physical body. Okay, they are the builders of the six out of seven of the principles, the higher principles. Okay, thoughts or questions? You're hanging in there, that's great. Okay, next. When the seed of the animal man is cast into the soil of the animal woman, that seed cannot germinate unless it has been fructified by the five virtues, the fluid of, or the emanation from the principles, okay, of the sixfold heavenly man. So, yeah, when procreation begins, that the purely physical plasm can't germinate, we're here being told, unless it is fructified by the spiritual plasm. Right? Only the spiritual plasm made up of the five subtle fluids or vibratory currents provided by the dhyani, are able to infuse the germinal seed of animal, man, and woman. Without the spiritual plasm, you have a body but no consciousness, right? Yes, Nadelle.
Is that saying essentially that you can't really have conception without a potentially overshadowing soul there to sort of be part of that process?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that the when the spiritual plasm comes into being, that it it is met by this when the physical plasm is initiated through the combining of the pairs of opposites on the physical plane, then it draws forth the spiritual plasm, which is a vibratory in nature. Theosophy uses this idea of fluids to represent substances that are not measurable physical substances, right, from the higher realms. Yeah.
I guess I've always thought of it in terms of you had conception and then an overshadowing jiva would then become part of the process. This seems to be saying that the jiva is part of the process from the very beginning.
Soul influence is continuous, right? I mean, the soul sends one into incarnation, so it's ever present, right? When a man and a woman add the commixture of their pairs of opposites, right, the spermatozoon and the ovum, then the ever present spiritual plasm, which is the nature of the soul sent forth into an incarnation, which is encoded, by the way, in the permanent atoms, right? You could say completes the process, right? But what I said earlier is actually incorrect, and I'm glad you asked this question, because it's not that, you know, the combination of the physical aspects necessarily attracts the spiritual plasm. That intention actually comes first. That spiritual plasm is the directing agency, right? And then that attracts a specific man and woman's contribution that allows it to then be physically manifest. In other words, the soul directs the whole incarnational process. And DK's getting into the weeds as to how that actually comes about. Okay.
Francis?
No.
And Veronica says that Master Hilarion talks about the seven breaths.
Yeah. Do you want to elaborate on that? The seven breaths would be very much like, if you made it six breaths, it would be like the dhyani contribution, right? Which are the principles that are embedded in this spiritual plasm that are then become part of the physical evolution or manifest through the physical evolution.
It's difficult for me to explain. I was translating Master Hilarion, and he talks about these seven breaths. And basically, it's what we are talking here. He was saying that the mineral has one breath and the plant has two breaths. It's the same thing as what we are describing here, but he says it's through the breath. That's how he calls it. It's very interesting to see.
Yeah. Breaths are a motive force. They actually make things happen, right? So the impress of each of these dhyanic, chohanic levels could be described as a breath, right?
Yes, I think it's the same thing. I will be sending you Master Hilarion's work so that you can paralyze with this, to parallel these, but it's difficult for me to explain. It's so much information in one phrase that, and in a language that's a bit older English, so it's not easy for me to explain him.
I understand.
So I will send it to you. Okay.
Sounds good. Okay. Next. Wherefore, the microcosm is represented as a pentagon within the hexagon star. The Macrocosm, a work on occult embryology, book one. Okay, so, and then Amvrotica told us that this is Anthroposos, which is the greater man, because, you know, the it's Greek for the macrocosm. So this is the heavenly man, or the archetypal man would be the Anthroposos. What? Go ahead.
Anthropos,
thank you. Okay.
But Anthropos means a human being. It doesn't mean the heavenly man, unless through what he says here.
Yeah, I think it's a specific usage of the term.
And Anthropos basically means one that looks above.
One who looks above.
Above, yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's the idea is that it's the archetypal man, and we know that from the fact that it's a description of the term macrocosm, right? Okay, so only when the spiritual plasm, I got lost. So every human being is symbolized by a five-pointed star, all right? So, whereas the cosmic prototype of the sixfold Dhyanis is shown as a six-pointed star. The pentagon represents the five lower principles that animate a human incarnation: manas, linga sharira, kama rupa, prana, and stula sharira, right? Lower mind, the astral, double, the desire body, life force, and the physical body. The six-pointed star stands for the six principal Dhyan Chohan, the cosmic architect. These 6 points correspond to Atman, which is spirit, Buddhi, or higher soul, Manas, mind, undivided, Kama Rupa, desire, Prana, life force, and Linga Sharira, etheric template. The pentagon within the six-pointed star symbolizes the fact that every human incarnation unfolds within and as a result of the consciousness of the sixfold Dhyanis, the greater builders, right? Okay, you see how that works? Sometimes, here's a great example of how a picture is like 1,000 words. You can see the relationship between an individual human being and the Dhyani Chohans from which the principles are drawn. Okay, next. Then the function of Jiva on this earth are of a fivefold character. So the indwelling Jiva, who is the soul in incarnation, expresses itself to the five lower principles as shown here, at least according to first generation theosophy. As to the cited Macrocosm, book one on embryology, theosophy buffs have been looking for this ever since the Secret Doctrine was published. It has never been found. and it would appear to be either an unpublished work. I suspect it's part of HPB's precipitated sources that she would just see before her eyes, right? Made available to her by her masters. And so real were those that she literally quoted them as if they were published articles or books. Okay, next. In the mineral atom, it is connected with the lowest principle of the spirits of the earth, the sixfold dhyanis. In the vegetable particle, with their second, the prana, life. In the animal, with all these, plus the third and fourth. In man, the germ must receive the fruition of all the five. So here, HPB connects the five lower principles of a human being to the lower kingdoms in nature. So could we get a reader for this chart, please?
Yes. Tom, can you read that for us, please? Tom?
Let me see if he's unmuted.
There we go. He just right. Unmuted.
Yeah, you can read them horizontally.
Okay, first is kingdom, then active principles. Mineral, connected only to the lowest Dian Chuan's principles, pure substance or life atoms that underlie matter. Vegetable adds the second principle, prana, giving growth, circulation, and basic vitality to plant life. Animal carries prana plus the third and fourth principles, kama rupa, instincts, emotions, and vinna sarira, astral form. And human receives the full fruition of all five lower principles, enabling physical life, mind, emotion, etheric body.
Okay, so this is pure first generation theosophy, which draws on the Vedantas and the Puranas, the Aryan ageless wisdom, where these are set concepts, right? Yes, Barbara.
I'm wondering about the connection of prana as described here and the spiritual plasm. So as I understand it, prana doesn't come in until the heart is ready to beat. So it seems to come in later than the spiritual plasm.
Yeah, the spiritual plasm, you know, that magnetic fluid is the impress of the primordial cell, which is made up of all the higher principles of a human being. It's that, that's the, it's some, that makes up the sum total of the spiritual plasm, the, all the higher principles in their impress on the lower. Whereas prana is a different thing. It comes through the interrelation of the pranic triangle, which is a material substance gain, that is an etheric material substance that is gained by means of the pranic triangle, which is in the throat, a center just below the, not the throat center, but a place near the throat, actually between the shoulder blades, a place just below the diaphragm and the spleen. So that generates the prana that when a human being actually draws breath or the heart begins to beat, it draws it into that human incarnation. And there's more about prana. There's solar prana, planetary prana, and the prana that all beings emanate, right? Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you very much. It was
Okay. So next up, could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Selena, can you read that, please? Selena? Okay, I don't see her unmuting, so let's go with Barbara. Can you read that for us, please?
Otherwise, he will be born no higher than an animal, namely a congenital idiot. Thus, in man alone, the jiva is complete. As to his seventh principle, it is but one of the beams of the universal sun. Each rational creature receives only the temporary loan of that which has to return to its source, while his physical body is shaped by the lowest terrestrial lives through physical, chemical, and physiological evolution. In quotes, the blessed ones have not to do with the purgations of matter, end quote. A Kabbalah Chaldean Book of Numbers. It comes to this. Mankind in its first prototypal shadowy form is the offspring of the Elohim of life, or Petris. In its qualitative and physical aspect, it is the direct progeny of the ancestors, the lower dhyanis, or spirits of the earth. For its moral, psychic, and spiritual nature, it is indebted to a group of divine beings, the name and characteristics of which will be given in Book 2. Collectively, men are the handiwork of hosts of various spirits. Distributively, the tabernacles of those hosts, and occasionally and singly, the vehicles of some of them.
Thank you, Barbara. Okay, first, otherwise, you will be born no higher than an animal, namely, a congenital idiot. And the otherwise is, I'll get to that. thus, in man alone, the jiva is complete. As to his seventh principle, it is but one of the beams of the universal sun. So otherwise here means without the spiritual plasm, right? The seventh principle refers to Atma, it's counting from below upwards, the divine spirit, whose expression through each individual is one of the countless rays emanating from the universal sun or life aspect. Notice that the sixfold dhyani chohans are the principles beneath this seventh, which is formless, entirely formless, and therefore not Devic in the builder sense. Okay. This is where that Atman sits in relation to the other principles. Next, each rational creature receives only the temporary loan of that which has to return to its source, while its physical body is shaped by the lowest terrestrial lives through physical, chemical, and physiological evolution. The quote, blessed ones have not to do with the purgations of matter. So again, you have that one in six division. This comes from the Kabbalah as well as the Chaldean Book of Numbers. So it is spiritual plasm streaming in through one's sutratma that is quote unquote on loan to ensure that the monad gains the benefit of an incrementally waxing self-consciousness that comes through each incarnation. The blessed ones have not to do with the purgations of matter is a concept found in both the Kabbalah and the Chaldean Book of Numbers, which underscores the idea that those perfected spiritual hierarchies, which are the source of spiritual plasm, remain above all material refinement. They've been through that stage. Now they stand beyond materiality, from our point of view, at least, altogether. Next, it comes to this. Mankind, in its first prototypal shadowy form, is the offspring of the Elohim of life, or Petris. In its qualitative and physical aspect, it is the direct progeny of the ancestors, the lowest Dhyanis, or spirits of the earth. For its moral, psychic, and spiritual nature, it is indebted to a group of divine beings, the name and characteristics of which will be given in Book Two. So, each new planetary cycle begins with a wave of creative, semi-intelligent hosts called the Elohim, which is Hebrew for gods, or in Sanskrit, the Petris, which means fathers. These Petris fashion the ethereal blueprint of humanity. Once these prototypes come into being, a second cadre of lesser Dhyani Chohans, or spirits of the earth, takes over. They draw on mineral, plant, animal plasm, and the laws of chemistry, physiology, embryology, etc., to build up the physical, etheric, and astral bodies. These quote-unquote ancestors are the divine architects of form, what HPP has been calling the Dhyani Chohans, working from the densest kingdoms up toward true humanity. Finally, humanity's inner light, mind or manas, soul essence, buddhi, and karmic awareness comes from a third group, the Manasaputras, or solar angels. They infuse the prototype with self-reflection, ethical impulse, and spiritual aspiration. Together, these three streams, the spiritual seed, the elemental builder, and higher inspirer, explain how man emerges, quote unquote, as a living synthesis of cosmic spirit, universal matter from top and bottom, and guiding intelligence. Any thoughts or questions? Okay. Finally, yes, Nadell.
So the influence of the higher depends upon the quality that's built by the lower. Would that be correct?
Let's see. The higher doesn't depend. It's very Aries. Aryan, in that it emanates the impulse of the will to be. That's its job. And then the response comes from the lower. And you have what we've been talking about throughout the footnote and this last text, which is this dual plasm, right? The physical plasm is then impressed by the spiritual plasm, which is the information stored in the permanent atoms and impressed by the Dhyani Chohans. So that is all, you could say, activated by the will to be of the higher source, the spirit source. What's what she calls here, what's she call it? All right. Divine beings, to a group of divine beings, the name of which will be given in Book Two. That's what she said about them. So it's a threefold process, right? As we know, in second generation theosophy, you know, which is you have spirit and matter, which are bound by Fohat, and then you have this intercessionary middle group, which are the solar angels, which overshadow and plant the spark of mind, which then allows the animal man to evolve into the fourth kingdom of nature and start responding to the fifth kingdom, right? So it's a threefold process. Not surprisingly, since all these types of energies are threefold. Anyone else? Okay, finally, collectively, men are the handiwork of hosts of various spirits. Distributively, the tabernacles of those hosts. This is nice because it explains what we were just talking about. And occasionally and singly, the vehicles of some of them. So humanity as a whole is shaped and overseen by multiple spiritual hierarchies, Petris, or fathers imprint the general blueprint of mankind. Elemental and nature spirits provide the formative substance, and Manasaputras guide our collective moral and psychic evolution. Distributively, the tabernacles of those hosts means that the human form and psyche are structured to house divine energies, with each person reflecting a portion of the greater spiritual host. And occasionally and singly, the vehicles of some of them refers to the rare avatar or master who chooses to incarnate into physical form for the furtherance of the plan. Do you understand this threefold process here? Okay, how are we doing here? Getting there. Actually, it's probably a good place to close out since we need to. Any final thoughts or questions about this? Some ways I apologize for the density of it. I see that most of you have hung in there, which is gratifying. Sometimes these footnotes get, really into the weeds. But if you stick with it, you come out with something worthwhile. So I appreciate that. Yes, Nadal.
I just find this to be more difficult to understand than even cosmic fire.
It is more difficult to understand than cosmic fire. You know, cosmic fire gets a bad name for, being abstruse. I think most of that just comes from the fact that it's long. You know, it's like 1,258 pages or something. So, so it gets this rep of being very weighty and heavy duty. But Blavatsky can really get into the weeds. You have to, it's like riding a wild horse. You really have to be willing to hold on, and really explore every little nuance, or it's easy to get lost, but ultimately she's cognizable. You can figure out what she's talking about.
I'm not suggesting cosmic fire is easy to understand. I'm barely understanding that.
I understand just what you mean. I don't think TCF is more difficult than many of DK's books myself, but I've been reading it since the 80s. So, I have some history with it. And when that helps to make it understandable, just to having spent so much time with it. But, there's parts of esoteric astrology that are certainly as dense, and in some cases, I think more dense, and raising initiations too can be difficult, At any rate, thanks for that. Anybody else?
Yes, Ben says the Chaldean Book of Numbers may refer to Westcott's book Numbers, their occult power and mystic virtue of 1890, Secret Doctrine of 1888. HBB liked his stuff, called him the best, most erudite, such a learned commentator.
Yeah, and by the way, Westcott is who we're studying in The Secret Teachings of All Ages right now is his book on the Mensa Isiaco, or the Bimbine table that has Isis in the middle of it. It's an Egyptian-like tablet that Westcott wrote a book on, and we're using that a lot. Well, really, Manly Hall used that book a lot in order to gain understanding about that feature. So yeah, he's a well-known theosophist whose works are valued. Thanks, Ben. Anybody else?
Lots of thank yous, but I don't see anything else. So you want me to do the dates?
Yeah.
Okay. Next on our agenda, because we're off schedule this whole month, but next month we go back for the right schedule. Well, sort of. The Secret Teaching of All Ages will be at 5 October, but it will be at 8 p.m., so 1 hour later than normal. And then the next TCF is going to be on 10 October at 7 p.m. And then the next Secret Doctrine will be on 19 October at 7 p.m.
Okay, good. So more or less back on the right time of the month, the first Sunday, the second Friday, and the third Sunday. So good. And I'll
Right. And
always.
then in November, we'll switch to 8 p.m. GMT for all of these, but that doesn't happen until November, except for the STOA, which we needed to change because of conflicting things.
Yeah, meaning that we keep the same local time
For here in the States and
for here
Canada.
in the States and Canada, right, and in some other places as well. So that was the idea behind that, that the time changes from the point of view of UTC, but not locally. But we'll talk about that at when that time comes. So thank you all very much. Appreciate you hanging in there. And yeah, we'll keep at it. Keep it going. All right. Till next time. Be well.